Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Russia. Try to talk maybe a little bit about current Russian politics, about relations between Russia and its neighbors, the rest of the world, particularly the United States. And our guest for the program is Stephen Kotkin. He is Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History, Professor of History and International Affairs, and Director of the Program in Russian and Eurasian Studies at Princeton. And he is a scholar that has been following events in Russia and the former Soviet Union for quite a long time now. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana later this week to deliver the keynote address for the Ralph and Ruth Fisher Forum for 2009. This is something that's held in conjunction with the Summer Research Lab on Russia, Eastern Europe, and Eurasia. This is the seventh conference in an ongoing series that's held every summer to honor the achievements of Ralph Fisher. He's an emeritus professor of history here at the University of Illinois, and his wife, Ruth, who together helped to establish Illinois as a leader in the field of Russian, East European, and Eurasian studies. This conference will be taking place beginning on Thursday, and the main feature is movement of people. The title for the conference, Russia's Role in Human Mobility. So that'll be going on later this week. And as I said, our guest, Stephen Kotkin, will be here to take part in it. Here this morning, he's joining us by telephone, and we thought we would see if we could talk a little bit more generally about Russia and current events in Russia. And he said, yes, he'd be happy to spend some time talking with us, and we're glad to have him as our guest. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and you'd like to participate in the conversation, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and if it would be long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We ask only people who calling in, we ask them to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving. But, of course, anyone is certainly welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Kotkin, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
We appreciate it. I was really struck as I was starting to think about our conversation by an essay that you wrote. It was published in the Prospect magazine. This was maybe a little bit more than a year ago. It was last spring. And the title that they put on it was Myth of the New Cold War. And it was talking about Russia and where Russia was at the time and about its relations with the rest of the world. And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about some of the ideas that you set out here, because I take the fundamental point to be that as people at this point were trying to think about where Russia is now and what its priorities are and what its governing principles are, you're saying that, well, you know, you should be realistic about where we've come from, what was going on in the early 90s and where things are now. It seems that you're saying is that, well, you know, perhaps Russia under Yeltsin was not quite what we think it was, and maybe now Russia under Putin is not quite what we think it is.
Thank you. Yes, I think that's an excellent place to start. I mean, let's think back a little bit, not too far back, but, you know, let's say about, 20 years. The Berlin Wall fell in November 1989. So 20 years from now, we'd be on the cusp of that, although, of course, nobody really saw that coming. I started teaching at Princeton University, my first job, in September 1989, and the wall fell 2 months into my first course. There was this thing called the Soviet Union, which was colossal. It was a gigantic state, very militarized. It had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and the missiles to deliver them right into your home. Not something suspected, not do they have a nuclear program, maybe they have a nuclear program, will their missiles actually work, can they send a missile to hit Alaska or Hawaii, as we suspect North Korea may or may not have such capability, even though their missiles go into the sea. No, this place had 40,000 nuclear warheads and the missiles to send them, as I said, right into your living room. And so this was a real colossal threat. the Cold War was serious. It was about the fact that the Soviet Union represented a threat, not only to the United States, but to the whole world. That's not to say that the way we fought the Cold War was always right. That's not to say that the Soviets lacked grievances on their side. I'm only saying that the Soviet Union and the Cold War with the Soviet Union were real. Today's Russia, after the fall of the Soviet Union, has little in common on a global scale with what the Soviets had. Russia is a regional power, not a superpower. It's impossible to have a Cold War with a regional power. It's a big regional power. It's an important regional power. It's a proud regional power. But it is not a global power. One could go on in this comparison, talk about the lack of a fundamental ideology like communism, which appealed to many people outside the borders of the Soviet Union. And therefore, the Soviet Union had a kind of cultural power, too, in its ideology and its model that, as I said, other countries saw as a possibility for them. Russia has no such model that commands the attention and the loyalties of elites in other countries around the globe. So we tend to fall back sometimes into a kind of Cold War rhetoric or Cold War thinking when things with Russia don't go our way today, because we're kind of used to that. There's a pattern that's been set up, and it's very different, for example, from how we deal with U.S.-China relations. Even though China pretends to be a regional power, it's more like a superpower, while Russia, which pretends to still be a superpower, is more like a regional power. So that was the basic idea of that piece of the myth of the new Cold War.
Yeah. Have we, do you think, overstated what was going on, or maybe the potential for democratic reform in the early 90s? You know, to the extent that now we're saying, well, you know, there was this real possibility, there was this possibility for democratic reform and the flowering of a new kind of Russia at the time that the Soviet Union came apart and Boris Yeltsin was the president, and that yet somehow it all tragically went off the tracks, and that then when Mr. Putin came along, he crushed any possibility of real democratic reform that existed, and in fact has reasserted the power of the central government, and on and on and on. I mean, that sort of presupposes that something real in the way of democratic reform was going on in the early 90s. Is that true?
You know, this question has to be looked at empirically. We have to look at the institutions. Sometimes we focus on elections, and elections can be very important. We're seeing this in Iran today. The opposition claims that the elections were fraudulent in today's Iran, whereas the establishment claims that they were real and that the current president won re-election by almost a two-thirds majority in the first round of votes. When you look at the question empirically, and this helps in understanding what's going on in Iran right now, when you look at Russia in the 1990s, what do you see? Was the Russian judiciary, the judiciary inherited from the Soviet Union, the communist-era judiciary that Russia inherited, you know, on January 1st, 1992, was that judiciary, let's say, a professional, extensive, inspiring judiciary? In fact, Russia had 7,000 judges on January 1st, 1992. It inherited 250,000 KGB operatives and 7,000 judges from the Soviet Union. The Russian judiciary in the 1990s grew. Today, it's about triple the size. Russia has a little bit more than 21,000 judges. It still has, unfortunately, no one knows because it's a state secret, but something on the order of more than 200,000 KGB operatives under a new name. The KGB is no longer called that. It's called the FSB, and there are a couple of sister organizations. So if you look at the Russian judiciary closely from the 1990s to the present, you don't see a professional, independent, strong judiciary in the 90s that was somehow overturned in the Putin era. On the contrary, you could actually make the argument that today's Russian judiciary is better than judiciary under Yeltsin, that judges are more professional, that there are more judges, that more things are being decided by courts than before. I wouldn't go too far in that statement. There were tremendous problems with the courts and judiciary in Russia today. But nonetheless, you cannot make the argument that Russia had a strong rule of law state in the 1990s if you look at the court system. Move to the Duma or the Russian legislature. Was the Russian legislature in the 1990s a powerful professional organization? I don't think so. Is the Russian legislature today significantly worse than the Russian legislature in the 1990s? Again, I don't think so. There were a lot of illiterate laws. That is to say, lawmakers passed laws in the 1990s that contradicted other laws that they passed. There was a tremendous amount of trouble with the Duma or the Russian legislature in the 1990s. Look at the civil service or the state, that is to say the executive branch of government. Once again, was there a civil service in the 1990s of professional, good governance, clean officials who predominated in a Russian state in the 1990s? Of course not. Most officials were inherited from the Soviet period. So if you take just a quick overview of the judiciary, the legislature, and the civil service or executive branch, you cannot argue that the situation in Russia today represents a significant deterioration in any of those three realms of government. On the contrary, it's either about the same or it's a little bit better in some cases. So what you had in the 1990s can't be called democracy. Yes, there were more elections, and there were the elections were more competitive. And as I say, that can be very important. But the state itself was illiberal and not a rule of law liberal state, liberal with a small L. The result in the 90s was that a president was sick. He was often not in his office. The 1993 constitution that passed under Boris Yeltsin in a referendum, by the way, they faked the results of the referendum in 1993, giving it more support than it actually got. That constitution in 1993 under Yeltsin is still in force today. And it's the constitution that President Putin worked under and that the current President Medvedev works under, with only very few changes. So, in fact, the problem in Russia was a kind of collapse of the Soviet executive branch, the stranglehold on power that the Soviet executive branch had was broken. For a time, this opened up space in the political realm and in the economic realm, which was very important to a lot of people. But there wasn't the kind of serious long-term institution building that would give you what we would call an enduring democracy.
So then, if for those people who talk about Mr. Putin and his effort to consolidate or to recapture central control, his power over the Duma, over regional governors, over state industries, over media and so forth, that's in a sense that's a return to status quo ante?
Well, under Yeltsin, you had regional leaders in the 90s who look like Putin looked when he was president of Russia. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they were dominant within their region. Sure, they were elected, but they manipulated the elections. They had a kind of quasi-democratic mandate from the election process, something Putin eliminated. He eliminated the elections for regional executives, and they're now appointed. So instead of having a centralized hyper-executive branch that was controlling and bullying, you had a whole bunch of regional executive branches, fiefdoms, that were corrupt and hyper-controlling. One of the things Putin tried to do, and this was a correct move in my view, was to try to break the power of these regional out-of-control executives. The way Putin went about that was not necessarily the best way. It was not necessarily a way I would choose, but the problem was real. So the re-centralization of the state under Putin, as you called it, a return to the status quo ante, was aimed at, properly so, aimed at these regional executive branches. The solution, however, is not necessarily better than what the problem was. From the point of view of Russian nationalists and patriots, they prefer a strongly centralized state. from the point of view of regional interests, many of them prefer to be the bosses, the primary bosses in their own realm. There's one caveat here, and that's to say that there are limits to centralization in a state as big as Russia. And there are tremendous interests in Russia that differ and clash. They clash over property and spoils and all the other things, perquisites. And that clashing of interests means that Russia is not a monolith, even though power is much more centralized in the central executive branch than it had been in the regional executive branches under Yeltsin.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Stephen Kotkin. He's professor of modern and contemporary history at Princeton University. He's also director of the program in Russian and Eurasian Studies and has been following events in Russia for some time now. He'll be here later this week on the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a major conference. This is the Ralph and Ruth Fisher Forum for 2009. He'll be giving the keynote address. It's a scholarly conference looking at mobility, movement of people in Russia, and that's sort of the main theme. And we asked Professor Kotkin if he would be with us here, spend some time talking in more general terms about Russia and its relations with the rest of the world, and he said yes, he would be happy to do that. So questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We hear now we have new administration. And now both the Obama administration and the Russian government are talking about trying to make a fresh start. And certainly relations between Russia and the United States were, rhetorically at least, rather tense during the Bush administration. And that was the point where we had all these people talking about new Cold War and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about the Bush administration approach to Russia, and if indeed you feel that it went wrong, where it went wrong?
U.S. policy towards Russia has not changed as much as it seems to change under different administrations. Now, atmospherics can change, and the current administration, President Obama, has done, I think, an effective job of lowering the temperature on some disputes and trying to find a kind of modus vivendi or way of getting along with Russia today. However, some of the clashes of interests, some of the difficulties in the relationship that we saw in the Bush administration, we still have. In other words, to put it as starkly as I could, U.S.-Russia relations didn't go sour because President Bush and Vice President Cheney were a little bit arrogant, and President Putin was a little bit prickly. Relations went sour, and they did go sour, because of differences over places like Ukraine and Georgia and former Soviet territories. There has been a fundamental clash of interests, the Russian side versus the American side, on policies towards these regions that are now independent states that used to be controlled from Moscow. That hasn't changed, and it's not clear to me how one manages U.S.-Russia relations when such fundamental differences exist. Let's compare China for a second. Now, China did not lose Tibet. China did not lose Xinjiang or New Province, its interior region where a lot of Muslims live. China did not lose Inner Mongolia. In fact, China reacquired Hong Kong, and China is also, let's say, committed to bringing Taiwan under its control, even though formally Beijing never really ruled Taiwan, but it feels that it's a province that it ought to be, quote, returned to China. Now, can you imagine if China had lost Tibet? If China had lost Tibet, if Tibet had broken free and become an independent state, and Beijing had been unable to do anything about it, U.S. policy would certainly be to recognize the independence of Tibet in this theoretical discussion we're having, and it would be to do everything it could to make sure that Tibet remained independent and that Beijing was not able to assert its political direct rule over Tibet again in this hypothetical scenario of Tibet having somehow broken loose from Beijing's control. So we don't have that in the relationship with China. China remains territorially the same state that it has been for a long time. However, in the case of the former Soviet Union, those states are now independent. Russia feels that it has, as stated by President Putin before and now President Medvedev, Russia feels that it has a privileged interest in its neighbors in the former territories it controlled. The United States feels that it should do everything in its power to maintain the independence and even, if possible, the Western orientation of these states. So when it comes to something like Georgia, where, as you know, there was a war last summer, or it comes to some place like Ukraine, where we have this clash of interests, where neither side is willing to, quote, give in to the other side and allow it to assert a privileged sphere in these places. So it's not clear to me how, after you improve the atmospherics, after you begin arms control negotiations, which the Bush administration was not interested in, but the Obama administration is interested in, and Russia is very pleased to begin such arms control negotiations. After you begin that, you hit up potentially against these inherent limits in the relationship, that is to say, in these territories where Russia sees a privileged interest and where the United States sees itself needing to defend the independence and, hopefully, from the U.S. point of view, the Western orientation of these states. That's the problem. That's the core issue in U.S.-Russia relations. That's where the rhetoric of the new Cold War came from, and that's the nut that I'm not sure the Obama administration will be able to crack.
All right. Let's talk with the caller. We have someone in Champaign, and they are on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I don't feel confident to argue this point with your distinguished guest, but if I ran by this concept that I think that the American response to, in the Cold War from the 50s on was disproportionate and distorted, like say like the nuclear weapons cancel each other out, make it a given that Stalin was like grotesque, you know, almost parallel to Hitler. But I'm struck by the fact that like we devoted a great deal of our resources and intelligence to like opposing the Russians. And we distorted our own system tremendously and did all sorts of sins overseas in pursuit of this American paradigm. And we had all these intelligent people trying to understand what was happening in Russia. Fast forward to Afghanistan, and the country that I'd spent my whole life spending 50% of my tax money developing a military to oppose couldn't take Afghanistan. You know, the CIA didn't forecast this. I wonder if we were ill-served by our experts in this matter. What do you think?
Thank you. I think that's an excellent question. My view on the Cold War was that it was real and it was necessary, but that many aspects of it can and should be debated. That is to say, one can have different views on whether the Vietnam War was necessary and whether it was fought properly by the United States. One can have views on many other issues that were put in a Cold War framework by the United States, not all of which necessarily had to be in a Cold War framework. So while I view the Cold War, as I said, as necessary and important, that doesn't mean we can't have a robust debate about many aspects of it. The issue that concerns me now, as a taxpayer also, is now that we won the Cold War, that is to say the Soviets capitulated, and they capitulated more or less peacefully, which is pretty shocking. As I say, they had the might, the wherewithal, to destroy the world many times over, but they didn't. They sort of let go. Now that they capitulated and that we won the Cold War, I wonder why we have so many institutions left over from the Cold War, still in operation, in fact, still expanding. One can look at NATO, which was an extraordinarily important military alliance during the Cold War, founded in 1949, and successful. We can look at NATO and say, well, if NATO was there to win the Cold War, and it did so, it played a role in that, what is its role today? Why would NATO be expanding today? What's the rationale for an institution that was very important in the Cold War to be even larger today in territorial size and in mission? So I think that's worthy of our discussion. In other words, We can disagree on the various incidents and policies during the Cold War, even if I might insist on the importance of the framework of the Cold War. And we can also disagree on the post-Cold War. But it's a debate we don't usually have in the United States. When you win, you don't have to take anything down. You don't have to say, oh, you know, we can't have this anymore. This institution doesn't work. So winning allows you to keep in place a whole lot of things that enabled the win, and then to find new missions for them or not to find new missions for them, as the case might be. This is a debate I think we surely could have, and it's part of the relationship we have with Russia. Is Europe secure? Is Europe secure today with an expanded NATO that excludes Russia? I think that's a debate we need to have.
Can I ask you an unrelated question? Somewhat unrelated?
Sure, go ahead.
To what extent do you think that Russia's backing of Serbia resonates with Russian people? I mean, is that much of an issue, or what do you think they have a geostrategic aim there? Or I'd be interested in your thoughts. Thank you.
Yes. Russia's most important relationship in the world is with Germany. Russia and Germany have a special relationship, close ties. They have close economic ties and close political ties. The Russian leadership listens to the Germans. They have their disagreements. But nonetheless, that's really where their core relationship is. Beyond Germany, Russia also has a strong, deep relationship with the French and also a developing, getting stronger relationship with the Italians. You'll notice that Russia doesn't take the European Union very seriously, but it has strong bilateral relationships with many European states, members of the European Union, which is a way that Russia, like China, blunts the possible collective power of the European Union while benefiting tremendously close ties with several really important European states. On the Serbia question specifically, I'm not sure how seriously we should take Russia's stance vis-a-vis Serbia. I'm not sure what the Russians would be willing to sacrifice on behalf of Serbia. Now, that's not to say that some people in the Russian establishment don't view Serbia as a close cultural and political ally of Russia. Yes, there are such elements in the Russian state, and yes, there are some people in the population who feel this way. But one wouldn't put Serbia at the top of the list of important states in Russia's bilateral relations. China on the other side, South Korea on the other side, less so Japan, and less so India, possibly Iran, although I think we overestimate Russia's leverage with Iran. So Serbia is there in Russian relations. But we tend to think, maybe exaggerate, as I think you're implying, the importance that Russia itself puts on Russian-Serbian relations.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Stephen Kotkin. He is Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History, Professor of History and International Affairs, Director of the Program in Russian and Eurasian Studies at Princeton University. And he'll be here on the campus later this week to take part in the Ralph and Ruth Fisher Forum for 2009. It's an international scholarly conference looking at Russia's role in human mobility, so looking at movement of people in Russia. That's a major focus of the conference this year. And our guest, Stephen Kotkin, will be the keynote speaker. Questions here, we're talking about Russia, and more generally, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just, we were talking a little bit earlier, you're talking about the fact that one of the points of tension between the United States and Russia does indeed have to do with the fact that the United States thinks it has interests, certain interests in Europe, and certainly that Russia thinks that it has continuing interests in those countries that were part of the Soviet Union before and are its immediate neighbors. Do you, just to ask a direct question, do you think that it was a mistake for the United States to press for the enlargement of NATO and the inclusion of some of these countries that either were part of the Warsaw Pact or were actually part of the Soviet Union?
You know, the first phase of NATO expansion, I think, was important. And it began with the Germans. Let us remember that the Germans were on the front line in the Cold War. Our state was divided into two states, the current unified Germany, that is to say. And the front line, that is to say the bayonets on either side of the barbed wire, ran right through Germany. The Germans wanted not to be on the front line anymore, not to be right in the center. They wanted the goalposts, as it were, to move. They wanted the front line to move. And so the Germans, I think, and properly so from a German point of view, favored a certain NATO expansion, at least a first stage of it. After that, it became a kind of trance. That is to say, it seemed to be, let's keep doing it, let's keep doing it, let's keep going. There were some questions about where it might stop and about whether an alliance that kept getting bigger was actually getting stronger, or whether an alliance that kept getting bigger was actually getting weaker. There were such voices along the way, but nonetheless, NATO expansion has gotten to the point where the previous American administration, the Bush administration, pushed very hard for inclusion of Ukraine in NATO. This didn't happen primarily because of opposition within the NATO alliance, including from Germany, as well as the fact that Ukrainians don't want to join NATO for the most part. Nonetheless, I think if one allows for a certain, let's say, sense for the first phase of NATO expansion, it's hard to justify NATO expansion ad infinitum. Let me just unpack the question a little bit here. If you think about this NATO expansion question, Article 6 in NATO says that an attack on any one member is an attack on all members. That means that we're duty-bound to go to war if an incident should occur against a NATO member. We had a very ambiguous incident in Georgia in August 2008. It seems to be the case that the Georgians attempted by force to regain territory that by international law was Georgian territory, but which the Georgians didn't control. Two breakaway statelets, Abkhazia and South Ossetia. It seems to be the case, as I said, that Georgia tried by force to regain territory that under international law belonged to Georgia. Russia reacted to this by launching a military operation in response. That military operation went pretty far into Georgia because the Georgian army, which the Americans had been supplying, didn't fight. The Georgian army fled. It left its weapons and its dead in the field, and the Georgian army did not even stop to try to form a perimeter around the town of Gori, which was on the approaches very close to the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. As a result of which, the Russians could just walk right through, and they could have gotten all the way to Tbilisi, in fact, but they didn't. They went into Gori, which, as I say, was left undefended by the retreating, Georgian army. This is not to justify Russian actions. This is not to suggest that Georgia is solely to blame here, because Russia had taken many aggressive actions over a long period of time, more than a decade, in the Caucasus, including granting citizenship, Russian citizenship, to people who lived on Georgian territory. So there's fault to be found on both sides, but nonetheless, here was a war that began in ambiguous circumstances. Had Georgia been a NATO member, as the Bush administration signaled it wanted, and as it tried to put on the agenda of the NATO alliance, the United States would have been duty-bound in these circumstances, in these ambiguous circumstances, to begin a war, to get involved in a war against Russia over these breakaway statelets in the Caucasus that are under international law, part of Georgian territory. That is to say, our boys and girls, our men and women, your kids and mine, would have been duty-bound to be flown on those transport planes to the Caucasus, into that war. So would we have done that? Would we have actually implemented the very policy we're signed on to, Article 6, an attack on one NATO member is an attack on others? I actually don't believe we would have. I don't believe we would. We're involved in two wars right now, in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't believe we would have sent our troops there, and I don't believe other NATO members, also duty-bound by Article 6 of NATO, would have sent their troops there either. Should such an incident happen elsewhere, Latvia, for example, which is a NATO member, that is to say, unlike Georgia, which did not get into NATO, so our discussion is hypothetical, the state of Latvia, an independent state, which has a population about one-third ethnic Russian. Should an incident break out in Latvia, would the United States and Germany and other members of NATO send troops to fight on the side of Latvia, especially if there's an ambiguous nature to how the incident got underway? I actually don't think so. So therefore, I mean, this is going to sound like heresy potentially, but therefore I think that Article 6 of NATO may already be a dead letter. That is to say, the ironclad NATO guarantee of the security of all its members, I'm not sure that ironclad guarantee is there anymore. In part because of this headlong expansion of NATO and the possibility that an alliance that got bigger also got weaker. So when the Russians come forward and say they don't like NATO expansion, that's not the argument against NATO expansion. An alliance has the right to expand and include any members it wants, and other states have the right to join any alliance they would like to see fit. So I agree that Russia should not have a veto over which members can belong to NATO. The argument against NATO expansion was not that the Russians would get mad, but that NATO would get weaker, that NATO expansion would weaken and potentially even ruin NATO. That was the argument against NATO expansion. I think that argument still holds. President Medvedev came forward and said he'd like to see a new security architecture for Europe. The United States did not dismiss this out of hand, but unfortunately there was no content in President Medvedev's proposal of what that new security architecture would look like. However, I think that even though NATO is a fabulous institution, even though NATO played an unbelievably important role during the Cold War, and even though the first phase of NATO expansion can be justified and makes some sense to me, that we're at the point now where it may be incumbent upon us to put content into the Russian call for a new security architecture for Europe.
All right. Let us talk with someone else who is listening, and this is someone here where we are in Champaign County. It's our line one. Hello.
Hi. I really appreciate your stance on NATO because it's one of the things I thought would be important to explore. And though I think there's some nuances I could delve into, I'd like to point out some other things. Actually, I wanted to ask you about how you follow what's going on at the Shanghai Council, the Cooperation Council, unproductively, I think, called BRIC here in the Western press. But before I do that, I wanted to mention I find that this great irony, and maybe you've already are sensitive to it, which is that Abkhazia and South Ossetia were variously added to, appended to Georgia when Stalin was quite the influential figure. I think it was the latter. Abkhazia was added when he was supreme dictator. South Ossetia was earlier when he was just a member of the Presidium. So you have this guy who was second in McCain's command, who was like a big money lobbyist for Georgia, defending the actions of the dictator in the decades earlier about where the territory should belong to. I find that just astonishing and pretty much uncommented on irony. I don't know, maybe people don't even appreciate what I'm talking about. But one of the things in the 90s that the idea of a possibility of a rebirth of or a birth of a democratic Russia was talked about. It seems to me that one can't comment but comment about the larceny of the times. And this is something that isn't just which is the privatization and the cronyism that actually should make Dick Cheney look a little embarrassed because it's a much wider scale. I wanted to ask if you know anything about the lawsuit that Russia had against the state, the Bank of New York Mellon, which they have a RICO case. There was some talk about an out-of-court settlement, but the idea is that they knowingly took assets that were privatized illegally with bribes, et cetera, et cetera. And that it's something like $8 billion, which, you know, isn't big for a big-tier bank. I think Bank NY Mellon, as they call it, is like a big second-tier bank. So $8 billion actually probably could bother it some. They're also half invested in the state, the National Bank of Georgia. I understand they own half of it, and they're well exposed in the former Soviet bloc, the Eastern Bloc states, which is probably why they're hoping that the bailout of that goes through the IMF. Anyway, I've thrown a lot out there, and maybe we can get back to the Shanghai Council. But I wanted you to comment on just some of those intricacies, if you would.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, a lot of things there. Just quickly on each one. The Soviet Union was stolen. Everyone who had an opportunity inside the state, controlling some property de facto, just about everybody grabbed what they could. Some people grabbed a lot more. Some people grabbed and had it grabbed by somebody else. But the Soviet Union was stolen. Having said that, there was an upside to this grand theft. And the upside was that Soviet officials did not try to defend the Soviet state with all their might. Their preoccupation with privatizing what they could is one of the reasons that the world didn't blow up. This is not to condone that type of mass insider theft. Tremendous injustices took place. And a lot of people were hurt. At the same time, this is one of the few empires that's ever collapsed without a major conflagration, without mass war, without huge numbers of deaths. So even though the theft was ugly, it definitely had an upside in peacefully bringing down the Soviet state. The Bank of New York was involved in accusations of money laundering, whereby money inside Russia left the country. Now, it's not possible to bring money outside of Russia unless you have cooperation with the international banking system. So when we called in the 1990s this the Russian money laundering scandal, we were only partly right. It's clear to me that the Bank of New York is located in New York. On to your other question. You asked a little bit about the Georgia situation, how Abkhazia was formed under Stalin. By the way, Stalin was a Georgian, and the Russians don't forget that, the Georgians today feel grievances under what they consider a Russian colonial occupation rule from Moscow, but the Russians feel grievances by the fact that so many Russians were murdered by Stalin, who was born in Georgia. As far as the borders in the Caucasus and what happened in the Soviet period and how Abkhazia and South Ossetia and Georgia were formed, it's a mess, and they're unjustifiable. That is to say, the borders in the Soviet Union were formed and reformed and unformed and formed again, not unlike the processes in Africa, for example, the so-called scramble of Africa. However, once these things took shape, and once the Soviet Union collapsed, there were 15 recognized successor states, the so-called Union Republics of the Soviet Union. There were, within each Union Republic, in most cases, so-called autonomous republics, some of which, like Chechnya inside the Russian Republic, wanted to break away from the Russian Republic. Russia was one of the 15 successor states to the Soviet Union as a Union Republic. Chechnya was not one of the internationally recognized successor states. They were just an autonomous republic in the Russian Union Republic. We have something like that in the case of Georgia, where South Ossetia and Abkhazia were not Union Republics in the Soviet Union. That is to say, they were not internationally recognized successor states when the Soviet Union broke up. But instead, when the Soviet Union broke up, Abkhazia and South Ossetia were part of Georgia. Abkhazia, for a time, was a separate republic, not included in Georgia. But under Stalin, it was put back inside Georgia. And the Abkhaz feel that this is an illegitimate decision, even if in 1991 Abkhazia found itself inside Georgia. This is only because of what Stalin did in 1931, and therefore it's illegitimate. I understand their argument. I appreciate their argument. Once you start with arguments like that, though, where do you stop? It's hard to justify any of the borders. And one can have an endless border rearrangement, grievances, right down to the village level of who wants to be in and who wants to be out. There has to be a way in which we do not allow people to change borders by force or by fiat. If borders ever change, and it's usually not a good idea, it should be through some process of mutual negotiation and mutual recognition, and certainly international recognition. As far as what's going on, if I have time, in Central Asia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, which has six members, four states of Central Asia, plus Russia, plus China. It's headquartered in Beijing, even though it's called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And it's having a meeting in Yekaterinburg, Russia, as we speak, where the six members, plus others who have advisory status, are there, and where the United States or countries of the European Union are not represented. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, so far, we have to keep an eye on it, sure, but so far it's not clear that it represents the kind of powerful organization antidote to the West that some of its members would like to see. The designation BRIC, there is a meeting of the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, four large emerging economies, BRIC being the name given by Goldman Sachs economists to these four countries in a profitable money-making way to organize investment in these countries for Goldman Sachs and others. They also had a meeting in the same town, Yekaterinburg, on the eve of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's not clear to me what could possibly emerge from that, although it's something that we should watch, whether or not these countries can develop organizations that support their interests as they see them in the international realm.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're coming down to the point where we have a couple minutes left. There's something I'd just like to return to for a moment or two, and unfortunately we only have a couple of minutes left, and that has to do with the clash between Georgia and Russia last summer. And questions that that I've had in my mind since, and I'm not sure that I have ever seen really well addressed, questions that seem to be rather basic ones, one being, what exactly did the Georgian president, Mr. Saakashvili, think that Russia was going to do when he did what he did? Did the government of Georgia tell the United States what it was planning on doing? And if so, what did the United States say? Do you have any thought on
this? This is an excellent point and very important. It's murky, however. We're not fully in command of all the information. This is what we do know. Members of the Russian government watched very closely anything that happened between the United States and Georgia, including intercepting communications, a lot of which were over cell phones. When a member of the U.S. State Department talks to another country, a record is not always kept. Certainly at the level of the Secretary of State, the record is kept. But at the level of an assistant or a deputy assistant secretary of state, a record is not always kept of telephone conversations. So ironically, we in the United States government don't always know, and in this case we don't know for sure, what people below the secretary of state were saying who were dealing with the Georgian president. The Russians, however, know, because their intelligence services intercepted some of these cell phone conversations. The facts, as we've been able to establish them more or less, Saakashvili miscalculated. He had been stating for a number of years, since his first election, that the territorial integrity of Georgia was very important to him, and he needed a way to restore the territorial integrity of Georgia. Former members of his government now accuse him of having had an idea to use military force to try to bring back these territories that Tbilisi, that is to say the state of Georgia, did not control. We have that, as I say, from former members of the Georgian government under Saakashvili, who've fallen out with him. So we don't know what he was thinking precisely. The Russians have a pretty good idea, as I said, about the communications. We do have a good real-time intelligence assessment inside the American government of what transpired. This is how we're able to more or less affix blame for the launch of hostilities to Saakashvili. The Europeans are currently conducting a major investigation. They've had a lot of interviews. We're expecting the report of the Europeans any moment into the events from August 2008 in Georgia.
Well, at that, we will have to stop because we're here at the end of our time. We want to thank the guest, Stephen Kotkin. He's a professor of history, professor of modern contemporary history at Princeton, where he's also director of the program in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and he'll be here later here in Champaign-Urbana on the campus to take part in the Ralph and Ruth Fisher Forum for 2009. It's a major international conference looking at the issue of mobility in Russia, and Professor Kotkin will be giving the keynote address. And thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.